Hi, this is Dr. Mike Barnes, and welcome to episode two of the Beyond Addiction and Trauma, the Family Recovery Podcast. The title for this edition or this episode is Families, Trauma, and Addiction 102. And in it, I'll be speaking about the concepts of secondary and systemic trauma. More specifically, I'll be speaking about how families can experience trauma or be traumatized by their day-to-day dealings with a loved one's addiction and associated trauma. I'll also be talking about how this trauma impacts the well-being of family members, as well as both emotionally and physically. And so welcome to the podcast. I hope you find it interesting. YouTube channel is Michael Barnes, PhD, LAC, LPC. Now, I did have some technical difficulties in this recording. If you go to the YouTube and you view the version there, you'll see the slides, you will hear my voice, but the recording of myself giving that presentation is not present. So it's not your system, it's my recording. So hope you find it interesting and hope you find it helpful. The other thing I want to talk about is I do have a book. It's called When the Solution Becomes the Problem, Helping Families Struggling with Addiction and Trauma. You can purchase it on my website, and both paperback and electronic versions. You can also get it at Amazon and other online booksellers as well. I hope you find this interesting, and please don't hesitate to comment, post questions that you have or suggestions that you have for future topics for the podcast. Thanks for watching, and I hope you find it helpful. Thanks. Welcome back to the Beyond Addiction and Trauma, the Family Recovery Podcast, and welcome to episode two. Episode two is titled Families, Trauma, and Addiction 102, a look at secondary and systemic trauma and how that impacts families with individuals struggling with addiction. And if you listen to or watched Families, Trauma, and Addiction 101, you saw a discussion about, what is addiction? What is it? Substance use disorder? How do we diagnose it? What are the symptoms of that? And then also kind of the beginning of how it begins to impact how families function. And so today we're going to talk about kind of a deeper dive. That's why I titled it 102, really kind of looking at how does addiction tend to create trauma or create circumstances that family members experience as trauma. And again, not to say that every family that has a loved one who struggles with a substance use disorder is traumatized, but the research that I've done and in interviewing families, so many of them say that they do experience trauma. And so let's kind of begin with a quick review. And in 101, I talked about the progression of the illness and progression of addiction as a chronic progressive disease, and how as the individual family member's addiction begins to grow, become more severe, having more and more symptoms, that the family functioning like a mobile over a baby's crib, as one person in the system begins to make changes, it requires everyone else in the family to begin to make some changes to try to regain or recapture a sense of homeostasis or a sense of balance. And so I showed a slide, if you were able to watch it, and you can find episode one on my YouTube channel, and you can get the PowerPoint, the slides, that really shows that over the course of time, as the addiction moves from the early phases into more severe behaviors, more extreme behaviors, that the changes that families make in terms of the rules of communication, rules associated with freedom of speech, and rules associated with how much emotion is allowed to be shared, and interactional rules, and how routines begin to change to try to control the situation, that the new normal that families create as the addiction is growing or becoming more advanced seem to work best when the person in the family is continuing to use than when the person begins to enter recovery. And so we talked a little bit about how clients kind of respond to that, or the identified patient in the family responds to that. And so today I want to talk about how significant these symptoms become and how family members really do experience them as traumatic experiences. And so if we think about the symptoms of addiction and we think about the symptoms of trauma, and we talked the other day or the in the first episode about how there's such a significant co-occurrence of addiction and trauma and addiction and depression and addiction and other kinds of mental health issues, that what is the family really responding to? And typically when I ask families about that, they just sort of focus on the addiction and identify a few things that seem to be most troubling to them. But I think sometimes it's really helpful to point out to families, these are the things that families say that they're experiencing. And so we begin to look at, there's the issue of intoxication, issue of anxiety and agitation, and people walking on eggshells and tiptoeing around so as not to irritate or create another big blow up or argument. Family members having intrusive thoughts, nightmares. Clients, the identified patient having intrusive thoughts and nightmares. People being dissociated. People expressing and experiencing depression, anger and conflict, arguments, defensiveness on a regular basis, unreasonable resentments and blame that, no one seems to understand my circumstances. No one seems to understand what I'm going through. Obvious hangovers, physical symptoms, medical symptoms, hospitalizations, financial problems, frustration. Remember, if it's like a mobile, if the family functions like a mobile, always trying to find balance, that we tend to think that each family member's response to the act of addiction in the family is in response to the family member with the substance use disorder. And that's not always the case. At other times, siblings of that individual who is struggling with the substance use disorder may be angry at their parents because of the behaviors of a sibling, I don't get to do the things that I want to do. Families will often talk about what they call the 80-20 rule, and the idea that 80% of their time seems to be focused on the individual in the family with the addiction or with the substance use disorder, and only about 20% on other family members, because the person with the substance use disorder is the one that needs the most attention. And so siblings become parentified and don't do things that they want to do because they're busy maybe taking care of their siblings. And so it's important to recognize that it's not all about the individual with the substance use disorder, but that everyone in that system, in an attempt to find that balance, is going to have their own issues, their own memories, their own frustrations. Other things that this family's dealing with are legal problems, arrests, employment issues, job loss. There's all kinds of things that on a daily basis, as the individual with the substance use disorder progresses to a more advanced state of their illness, that the family continues to have to make these shifts that become routinized, that become kind of daily activities and become a new normal. And so the goal for families in family recovery is to create not a new normal, but a newer normal. And oftentimes families will say to me, "Boy, if my loved one would just get sober, we could go back to normal." Well, that normal in their mind is back before the addiction started, or before the mental health issues started, or before the trauma happened. And it's very hard to go back to those after dealing with the things that I just talked about, all of these various symptoms that are causing this balancing act by family members to be able to hang in there and survive. The other thing that's important is that the traumas don't necessarily have to be happening in the current generations, the current iteration of this family. That in many cases, we look at trauma as being transgenerational, and that there may be addiction in prior generations that kind of have influenced how the leaders of a family make the decisions about what to do next and how to cope and how to manage. And again, it's not about blaming anyone, but it's about gaining insight and understanding that we did the best we could do with the information that we had and with the experiences that we had. And I can say that my grandfather was a very chronic alcoholic, and my mother experienced a lot of trauma through his addiction. And while there was no addiction in my family of origin, that transgenerational trauma from prior generations into our generation was very present and very very difficult. So oftentimes when I ask families if there was a history of addiction in prior generations, they'll ask me, "Well, what are you trying to say? That it's my fault?" And I said, no, not at all. We're not trying to blame anyone, but we are trying to really begin to look at how do we understand how we got where we are, so that when we're ready to make change, that we don't do the same things over again. The title of my book is "When the Solution Becomes the Problem: Helping Families Struggling with Addiction and Trauma," and I named it that for this very reason: the idea that so often, families are trying everything they can think of to solve this problem, to assist their loved one, because of prior generations, cultural issues, religious issues, histories of other chronic illnesses in families, that the family's John Roland, who's a medical family therapist and a psychiatrist, talks about how families decide what to do about chronic illness comes from the prior three generations, and how it helps the family to develop a set of kind of health and wellness schemas. And is it okay to ask for help? Is it okay to have problems, but still be okay? And so this transgenerational issue is really important. So as we begin to look at trauma, when I was the clinical director at the Center for Dependency, Addiction, and Rehabilitation at the University of Colorado Hospital Health System, a program that was a joint venture between the hospital and the School of Medicine, I did research with the families in our family program. And I asked them a series of questions. And one of the questions that I asked was, and we had a 260 family members in 1 year who took the pre and post test. And so, of those 260 individuals, I asked, is living with an actively using family member with a substance use disorder experienced as being traumatizing for their families? Of those 260 people, 74% said that they strongly agreed that it was very, very traumatizing for them. 21% agreed that it was traumatizing. And so, of that, 95% of the 260 participants said that living with an actively using family member, an actively, a family member with an active substance use disorder, was experienced as being traumatizing for them. And a quote that I use all the time, and it's from another research project that I had done with families in a psychiatric hospital at Sarasota Memorial Hospital, where I worked right after, soon after graduating from my doctoral program. And it was an interview with a mom. I interviewed families, and it was an interview of a mom who had a 20-year-old daughter who was actively struggling with a severe opiate use disorder. And the mom, and I'll just read her statement. She says, "You know, it's really been overwhelming. I can sit here calmly and talk now, but that's not the same as when I don't know where my daughter is or what's happening. And I'm getting phone calls from somebody on the street saying that she's been beaten and she's been raped. You know, really bad things are happening to her. It's not such a calm feeling when you get those phone calls or you get phone calls in the middle of the night. I think there's a sort of post-traumatic stress disorder for families going through this." And I thought that was so insightful on her part. And this, we call this kind of trauma secondary trauma. And there are aspects of it that I consider to be systemic trauma. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those symptoms in a few minutes, about what living with traumatized family members create within family systems. So in that study, at Sarasota Memorial, I had asked the families you know, they had indicated, I never used the word trauma in the initial inquiry with the family, but everything they told me was very consistent with trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And so the second set of interviews that I did with them, I asked, since you mentioned trauma as an experience with a loved one's mental health issues and addiction, what are the things that are most traumatizing for you? And the thing that was really interesting was that the very first thing that most of them said was that it was the shattering of dreams. And so whether it was a partner and the dream of our marriage is going to be a certain way and we're going to have kids and, you know, grandkids, and it's going to be this wonderful relationship. And then the addiction kind of shatters that, and they're dealing with all the problems that we just talked about. Or whether it's a child or a sibling, and the idea of this person's maybe probably never going to be who I thought they would be. They're not going to live up to their expectations. And when I talk to families about this in our group, they almost always relate to that idea of shattered dreams, the idea of a kind of a grieving process about the would have, should have, could have beens in our relationship or with our loved one. Other things that they talk about that they experience as particularly traumatizing would be dangerous and out of control behaviors, yelling, arguing, threatening, violence. In some families, there are weapons and there's actual physical violence and assault. Legal involvement, DUIs, drug charges, police actions, jail and prison risk, commitment for psychiatric issues. Emergency room visits, life-threatening medical conditions, sudden unexpected crisis calls. They talk about those calls that come in late at night when, you know, you're not expecting it, but you're expecting it. And the anxiety that happens when it's that evening time and the day's winding down as to what's the next crisis that's going to happen. Overdoses, potential overdoses, suicide attempts, suicidal ideation. Loved ones' victimization, sexual assault, physical assault, you know, injuries experienced by loved ones from fighting and arguing and other kinds of victimization. And the last thing they talked about that seemed particularly traumatizing to them was psychotic and really depressive symptoms, the sense of hopelessness, the sense of helplessness. And so I asked the family members that I had asked that were part of that study a simple question. And after we had kind of talked about the traumas, I said, if you were to receive a phone call from a friend or a family member, and they kind of knew the struggles that you've had with your loved one, with their addiction issues, mental health issues, trauma, and all of those things, and that they were to share with you that they have a loved one who's the same age, gender, relationship that yours is with you, and that they want to know what life is going to be like going forward with a loved one with these issues. And the families just did a phenomenal job of discussing the experiences that they've had as a family with an actively using addicted person in the in their family. And when I took all that information, I coded it, and I kind of looked, there were very clear patterns of emotional responses, very common cognitive thoughts and responses, very common physical symptoms that the families talked about, very consistent behavioral responses, and then very common defense mechanisms. And so emotionally, what families talked about were this wide range from anger and fear and grief, guilt, at times horror or terror of what's going to happen next, being in a state of shock at times, severe hurt and pain, depression, frustration, shame, and that those weren't all present all the time, but that those were all potential emotional states depending on what was going on with their loved one. So often when we're doing our group and we ask a family member, how are you doing? They tell us how their loved one is doing and then say, well, since they're doing well, then I'm doing well. And so that idea of family recovery is sort of moving beyond that to getting in touch with yourself and being aware of your feelings and that you can be okay even when your loved one is struggling. And you can struggle even when your loved one's doing great. And so it really depends on what's going on. Common cognitive responses. Families talked about helplessness and the sort of fear of the future, kind of thinking about what's going to happen next. What's going to, if things don't get better, what's it going to look like for this family? They obsess about it. Remember that 80-20 rule that families talk about is, you know, I think about them all the time. They talk about having intrusive thoughts when they're supposed to be working, they're supposed to be sitting at their computer, and all of a sudden a thought pops into their head. I wonder if they got to that doctor's appointment today. I wonder if they went to their meeting today. Hope they're doing okay today. A lot, they talk about a lot of uncertainty and at times vacillating between blaming others and blaming themselves and blaming the client and the idea of if it's got to be somebody's fault when in reality, it's in many cases, as we talked about in the first episode, you know, it's genetics or it's environmental or epigenetic, you know, those kinds of things. It's about trauma. Families talked about resentments and resenting their loved one for making promises that they don't live up to, resenting other families that don't have these problems that they're dealing with on a regular basis. Sense of hopelessness. Common physical symptoms that they talked about is most of them talked about having trouble sleeping, having trouble falling asleep, having trouble staying asleep, a constant state of worry, exhaustion, nightmares, startle response to where they start if they're so deep in thought about thinking about this loved one that if someone walks into the room, they have a startle response. Common trauma response, the startle response. Common behaviors, hypervigilance, control, trying to control others and trying to control themselves so that they can be the best loving parent they can be or the best partner that they can be. They take care of people. Often, you know, it's incredibly loving behavior. And sometimes it's not with great boundaries, so that it has maybe the opposite effect than intended. They try to structure people in their lives, And they work hard to avoid triggers and reminders. And the last is defenses, and they talk about denial and rationalization, intellectualization, the idea that there's perfectly logical reason for all of this, and then projection. It's if somebody was different, then we wouldn't have this issue. And so the themes that jumped out at me when I did the research was these sort of two patterns, one of anxiety and worry, and the other of hypervigilance and control. Anxiety and worry are symptoms of what we would call sympathetic nervous system dysregulation, fight or flight, being in a constant state of readiness for the next thing that's going to happen. And hypervigilance and control are also ways that individual families and individual family members maintain safety in their family. And so it's important to kind of begin to recognize that the patterns are pretty significant and pretty similar. Now, I have, if you're watching this, you can see a slide that has all of that information on it. I have shown that slide to, I have to think, 1,000 families over the years. And I have yet to have a family say to me, "Wow, boy, that's really interesting," because we don't relate to any of that. Most families talk about, "Wow, it's almost like you were watching us. You know, we have almost all of that. We have so much of that." And so I think the families did a great job of articulating what their experience is like, and the consistency between the families and the family members was really striking to me. And in 101, I showed a slide that really shows it's an assessment that we do in our current family program with family members when they come into the program. And so often families will say, "Well, why do I have to do any of this stuff? I'm not the one that has this problem." And so this is a good indicator, and it supports everything that I just talked about in that previous section about how families describe their experience. But symptoms that families report, feeling tired and lack of energy, 50%, 48.8% say, "Yeah, sometimes I'm really tired and exhausted." And 42% say, "Yeah, I'm almost always exhausted." Feeling nervous, 50% sometime, and 44% often. Feeling scared or frightened, 48%. Sometimes 23% often. And remember, scared and frightened are threat. And threat is what activates the fight flight response. And so that sympathetic nervous system response plays into everything from the functioning of our prefrontal cortex, our ability to remember things very well, to access new information. There are so many things that fall apart when we get highly anxious or highly activated, that create problems within the family when trying to deal with addiction. Things like restlessness and feeling jumpy, 56% said that they sometimes feel that, and 15% said often. Poor memory. Remember, I just said about the prefrontal cortex not functioning in high states of anxiety. And so poor memory was 56, 57% sometimes, and 23% often. Feeling guilty, 29, 20, 52% sometimes, and 30% often. Worry, 29% and 67%. Irritable, 71% sometimes, and 18% often. So everything from sleep disturbances, 47% sometimes, 34% often. And so it really supports the report that the families gave us. And so other information, and we'll do a deeper dive into secondary trauma at some point in this podcast. But I think it's important to recognize that our diagnostic and statistical manual of the American Psychiatric Association says that there are four ways that individuals can experience a traumatic event. or can respond to a traumatic event. And it's how they define whether something is traumatic or not. And so I have a son, he's 38 years old. He's healthy, has a fabulous, beautiful family, two great kids, beautiful wife, successful attorney, doing great. But when he was 5 years old, he got hit by a car. And he split his liver almost in half, broke his femur in half, split a kidney almost in half, landed on a red ant pile. We were in Tallahassee. I was in my doctoral program at the time. And so I want to use these, I want to use our family as an example of how everyone in the family can experience these events in really different ways. And so the first criteria is individuals who experience a personal experience of an event that involved the threat of death, actual or threatened serious injury, or threat to physical integrity, which is the loss of function. And so our son clearly experienced a personal experience of an injury that was life-threatening. His mom was standing about 10 yards from him when he got hit. And so she watched him fly through the air. And so she assumed that he had died. That was her initial response. So witnessing an event that involves death, injury, or a threat to the physical integrity of another person is just as traumatic as to the witness as experiencing is, or it has the potential to be just as traumatic to the person witnessing the event, particularly if it's your child or if it's a family member, as the person who experienced it. I didn't witness it. I was at school. I was in the clinic where I spent a lot of my time. Police officer shows up in the clinic and says, "Are you the father of this kid?" And we have a conversation, and he tells me what happened. The third way that we can react is that any family member who learns about the unexpected or violent death or serious harm or threat of death or injury experienced by a family member or other close associates. And so, while Patrick's experience and memory of the event were specific to his experience, and my wife's experience of witnessing the event was unique to her perspective, and my response was so much more about less about the event and much more about the intensive care unit and the medical. The threat of death and during the medical time. And so to assume that everyone's experiencing a trauma in the same way is really an error. Everyone has their own experience of it. They have their own sensory experiences of how they learned about it and how much fear there was at the time and how much urgency there was at the time. So that idea of, well, I've never been traumatized, but I've certainly witnessed things with my son, daughter, husband, wife, partner, whatever, where I, got a call in the middle of the night that this thing was happening and that there was the threat of death. So these are really important. And the last one is, and I think this is every family that has a loved one who struggles with addiction, is individuals who experience repeated or extreme exposure to aversive details of traumatic events. Now, that criteria was placed in the DSM-5 to address the needs of first responders, police officers, but for families, they are living and reliving traumatic experiences. Not all families, but a lot of families that are experienced as traumatic for them. And so, in my research that I did for my doctorate, my dissertation, I studied the secondary trauma of parents of kids who get hit by cars or have other kinds of medical concerns that require pediatric intensive care treatment. And what I found was the things that I learned in that study were not only consistent for the parents of kids that experience those kinds of physical traumas, but with all of the traumatized families that I worked with While I was working in the Vietnam Veteran Families Project and in the Psychosocial Stress Research Center. And so I generalize some of these things to traumatized families and not just with addiction, but with other traumas as well. And again, we kind of clump everything into the substance use disorder, but there are certain things that certain individuals experience, like, near-death experiences and overdoses and things like that, that maybe others or other families don't deal with. So we have to take all of this into consideration. And I'm not trying to say that every family is traumatized. And I'm not saying every client in an addiction substance use treatment program is traumatized, but a lot are, and enough to require a need of addressing it. And so what I found was that family members experience and talk about the same symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, even if they don't have the full meet all of the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. They talk about a lot of the symptoms that are consistent with that: anxiety and fear and anger, intrusive thoughts about traumatic events, nightmares, flashbacks. Flashbacks are kind of thinking about it and then imagining being back in the traumatic experience. Hypervigilance, that being constantly aware and looking for the next problem that could come up to try to control everything. Sleep disturbances, fatigue, dissociation. And dissociation is that the activation of the freeze response in the trauma response. And so the fight flight process stays active until it becomes overwhelmed or until the nervous system begins to recognize that this is not going to go away. And the sympathetic nervous system, fight flight, makes way for the parasympathetic nervous system, the freeze response. And we call that dissociation, a lack of being present but not feeling anything, being present but being numb to anything, feeling detached and estranged from others, things like that. So these are what I call axioms, testable hypotheses. The first one was the family members experience symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The second thing that came out of my study that I found really fascinating was that the longer families wrestled and struggled with active addiction or trauma, the longer the family stayed in a fight or flight response, that their worldview began to change and their perception of the world began to change to be much more focused on personal vulnerability, safety, and control. Meaning they became more hypervigilant, more controlling. And so many of the things that family programs talk to families about and the need to change things, like they need to quit being so controlling of their loved one, they need to stop enabling, they need to not be so enmeshed, which is connected and trying to be in charge of everything, stop being so overprotective, things like that. And I think if you talk to anyone, I'm just going to use the example of enabling, and I do not like the word enabling. I think enabling is a trauma response. I think if you ask anyone who has been told by a mental health professional to stop engaging in enabling behaviors without teaching you that person how to do it, I always say it's like Nancy Reagan telling an addict to just say no. That when they enable, it's usually because they're really terrified that something bad is going to happen and that they're anxious. And so I do an exercise with families about, let's talk about a time that you have enabled your loved one and that you've been told not to pay their rent or whatever it is that they do. And they talked about how as they tell the loved one that they're not going to pay the rent, and the loved one begins to get angry and start to say things like, I'm going to be homeless, I'm going to be, on the street, that their heart starts to race, and their pulse is stronger, and they get nervous, and they get anxious, and and that's a sympathetic nervous system response, a fight or flight response. And so it's really important for family members who are really looking at these changes to learn how to regulate the autonomic nervous system, how to calm the nervous system down, how to engage in grounding exercises to stay safe, and to begin to look at, these are the things that happen when I get afraid. These are the things that happen when I try to control everything. And so again, these are natural, normal things that loving families do because they're terrified that their loved one's not going to be okay. And so we could do whole podcasts on that one. The other thing that I found in my research was that the family's perception and understanding of the problem that they're trying to solve was far more important than the reality of the problem they were trying to solve. Meaning, and if you look, I'm looking at a slide and it says that the crisis is not the problem. It's the family's constraining beliefs that restrict alternative views about the crisis that become the problem. And so, we have a stressor, and it might be the addiction and trauma and depression. It might be, the threat of prison, the threat of death from medical complications, whatever is all tied together as part of the substance use disorder. And that professionals like me generally try to give you resources. And families ask me all the time, what do you think I should do? And I used to tell them, and now I ask families, well, if I tell you, will you do it? And the answer that is most common is, well, it depends on what you tell me. And as we begin to unpack that, it's really, if you tell me something that seems logical based on how I understand the problem, there's a chance I'll do it. But if you're telling me to do something that doesn't make sense to me, or is outside of my understanding of what I'm dealing with, or what my son or daughter, husband, wife, partner, whatever is struggling with, I probably won't do it. And so I think of a, I saw a podcast, or it was a TED Talk by Simon Sinek, and he said, people will ask you what to do and how to do it, but they're not going to do it until they understand why it's the best thing for them to do. And so for families who are wrestling with a loved one's active addiction or trauma, it's really important to begin to look at, how do I understand the problem? Based on my understanding, what solutions am I willing to do? I'm going to do another podcast on what I call the parallel process. And the parallel process is the similarities between what individuals who have a substance use disorder have to kind of go through to change their understanding of what they are dealing with so that they can take different actions to stay sober or to gain sobriety or recovery are not any different than what families have to do. And so it's important to be open. And in my book, I say that new insights allow new solutions. New solutions create new behaviors. New behaviors create better relationships. Better relationships promote family healing and family recovery. And so often it starts with a paradigm shift into, so this is why you're asking me to go into recovery too. And that's what if I were your therapist, that's what I would be doing. I'd be asking you to go into recovery. And the last thing I learned in my research was there is something that I termed systemic traumatic stress. And it's what happens when everyone in a family has been traumatized. And remember, I said each person's memory is going to be different. Each person's experience is going to be different. Each person's focus is going to be somewhat different. And so, what we begin to see are these increases in conflict and anger and resentments at family members, emotional distancing or emotional intensity, shifts in intimacy, shifts in parenting, shifts in decision making, those kinds of things. And with that, or associated with that, are what we call is what we call family organization, the five R's: rules, roles, routines, rituals, and relationships slash boundaries. And what we find is that in many families, as the kind of addiction behaviors progress, that families' boundaries begin to change, and they aren't necessarily as social as they once were, and they don't allow new information in. They want to keep things secret so that other people aren't telling them what to do or judging them harshly. They have often very what we would call diffuse internal boundaries, which means that parents become over-involved in their kids' lives and kids become over-involved in their parents' lives. We begin to see triangulation where if the family member who is the identified patient is one of the kids or a sibling in there somewhere, that if the two adults in the family respond to that person in different ways, one believing the person needs more love and more care, and the other one's a tough love person, it begins to shift the relationships between the individual with the substance use disorder and with the trauma, and with each of their adult people in their lives. And this can be in any configuration. It's just easier to describe. And then the only one who really doesn't make a lot of change in this is the person who needs to make the change, and that's the person, the primary person who needs to make the change. So these are the things that I would want you to recognize, that if 101 focused on the impact of addiction behaviors, the signs, symptoms, diagnostic criteria of addiction, 102 is about how traumatizing that can be for family members and how family members create behaviors that are designed to keep things as safe as possible. And that's why when people say, well, you should try this or you should try that, that oftentimes family members don't do that because it seems really scary to do that. It doesn't fit their understanding to do that. And so I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you hanging in here for this discussion. And be on the lookout for episode number 3. Thanks.